Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Blood, Sweat, and Strife. This is a podcast about history covered from a more left perspective. My name is Mason. I go by any pronouns.
I'm Jeremy.
I'm Isabel.
I go by he, they. Oh.
You go ahead, Jeremy.
No, it's too late now. We have to cancel the show.
All right. Well, ending recording. We're done.
Actually, I think we should leave that in. That was kind of funny.
We could do that. I'm Isabel, and I go with she, her pronouns, and sometimes I also go by Izzy.
I'm Jeremy. I go by he, they, or he, him. It doesn't really matter to me.
Cool. So today on this wonderful podcast of ours, we are going to be talking a little bit upfront about some pretty big concepts. It occurred to us in the last episode, we briefly touched on the topics of the labor theory of value without actually calling it by name. And also, we talked a little bit about what a crisis of overproduction is. And basically what a crisis of overproduction is you produce too much of a good, so this causes wages to fall, and then this causes the company operators to cut workers' wages.
Because they need to
make up for that loss of profit somehow.
Right. And it's a cycle. It ultimately works in a sort of cycle.
Yes.
Because what'll happen is it okay if I go into this in detail now, or?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, cool. Sorry, I didn't know if you were done or not. I didn't want to just step on you. But it generates a cycle where you end up, once you have the crisis of overproduction, and this is a cycle that is inherent in capitalism. So there's a reason why we go from crisis to crisis to crisis every few years with our financial system. And this is a big part of why. The companies, during the time of economic downturn, a lot of these companies will go belly up and they will not be able to operate anymore. And so you end up with depressed wages, people that are out of work, and an overall decrease in production. What'll happen is the companies that survive will eventually start to thrive as the economy begins to naturally recover. And because there's all of these companies that failed and that went out of business, there's also all of their equipment and so forth is out there now too, and it's cheap. And so these companies go through and they buy up all this equipment and they start to tool up to meet these growing production demands that they have, until eventually we get to the exact same point again where there's too many companies all tooled up creating too much and the market cannot sustain it. And so you end up in yet another crisis of overproduction where you see prices start to collapse again and these companies cannot sustain their businesses anymore.
Yeah, let me add just a little bit onto that if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
A good modernish example of this would be, say, look into where the Got Milk commercials came from, or why we use corn syrup in almost all of our food products here in the United States.
Yeah.
It's because there was overproduction of milk and corn. Corn is very easy to grow, and it grows very quickly. So we had an overabundance. People weren't buying it. And some crafty folks over in a laboratory somewhere found out that it could be made into a sweet syrup that could be added to things to enhance the flavor. And eventually, it made its way into everything we eat today here in the United States. And
right.
With milk, there's not really much you can do with it because it expires so fast and it's hard to make it shelf stable in some products. So they just made an advertising campaign to try to get people to buy more milk, playing up the health benefits of it, you know, saying it would cure all your diseases. That's a joke. They didn't do that, but
it'll make you fly.
It'll make you fly. Right. Red Bull gives you wings, but it was milk.
Right.
You know, you got well, the commercial what where the kid drinks the milk, they get the mustache, they flex their muscles, and that, you know. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, what was the slogan? Milk, it does a body good, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was told that milk would give me strong bones.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I break my bones every night. I. They're actually very brittle, and I drank milk every day.
Yeah.
This is bullshit.
I have glass bones and paper skin.
Yeah.
The kids used to call me Mr. Glass.
Every night I break my arms, and every evening I break my legs. All of this is super relevant because these crises of overproduction can be found in the production of coal. I read this one work that was about competition in the coal industry, and one of the things they mentioned was that coal has a tendency towards overproduction because during the year, a lot of people stock up on coal for the winter. Then there's a fall in demand, so the company isn't moving as much product, and then there's a fall in their profits, which really upsets them. So then they decide to cut workers' wages to make up for those profits somewhere.
Right.
And just and like that's something... Izzy said, this is inherent in capitalism. This happens every 5 to 10 years.
Exactly. And that's something I think that's important to keep in mind, too, is a lot of the cuts aren't necessarily because the businesses themselves can't survive. It's what they just aren't profitable for a period of time. They just aren't making extra money for the people on top. It's not like suddenly the people are working less or anything like that. That's not what's happening. There's not less value going into the product. It's that it's just not as profitable at these times.
Yeah. And I think that's actually segues very nicely into the labor theory of value, which you're also more knowledgeable on than I am. So want to take that?
Yes. And real quickly, just as an addition to what we were talking about with what Jeremy was talking about with milk earlier, because milk has such a short shelf life, do y'all know what they tend to do with milk when it hits a crisis of overproduction?
They dump it.
They dump it.
They dump it. They do that with a lot of food that we overproduce.
Yes. A lot of food in this country that we overproduce is just destroyed.
I'd also like to add that we dump bleach on it so people can't dig it out of the trash and eat it in a lot of places.
Right. Right. Because it's literally directly harmful to the bottom line of these companies to give that food away for free. Because from their perspective, if those people aren't starving, then they're not going to be in the store spending money.
And this has always been the case. You can go back and read accounts from like the 1800s and the 1900s of farmers or the people who like own the farm companies dumping gasoline on massive amounts of crops and setting it on fire. Because why would people pay these exorbitant prices for goods if there wasn't an enforced artificial scarcity?
Yeah, I mean, exactly, exactly. And in fact, much of our economy is built on enforced artificial scarcity.
Think about luxury cars.
Right. Our modern economy is basically built on a lot of enforced artificial scarcity. Yeah, we put a price tag on stuff that there's just no need to. I think it's important that we understand where profit comes from when we're talking about these issues. Because there's so like it's already bad enough. Like the stuff we've talked about these company owners, the stuff that we've talked about them doing already was really beyond the pale as it is. But when you put into context what not just them, but all businesses do in order to generate profit, to me, at least, it feels even worse because ultimately what it boils down to is there is no profit for these people without some level of exploitation of labor. All profit value that is generated is from underpaid labor. And a lot of people are going to be like, wait, what? That makes absolutely no sense to me, or how does that work, or they're at the very least going to be skeptical of it. And to those people, I say, go fuck yourselves and let's continue. So, labor theory of value. The best way to look at this, I think, is to start simple. To start with a very simple economic model where you're looking at, you know what, I'm going to use one that I was talking with somebody else about. Let's take a hypothetical market. It's a completely closed economy and it's a barter system. So there's no outside influences in it. It's just a bunch of people that trade with each other. And the stuff they have to trade with is all stuff that they made themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to trade with someone else, let's say that where you live, you're able to grow potatoes, right? And so you put in the work, you use your labor to grow those potatoes. The ground itself doesn't have any inherent value. The potato seeds, the potatoes before they're planted don't have any inherent value in them until you've actually done something with them. You know what I mean? Like the value that's inherent in them, it can't be accessed without labor.
Mm-hmm.
Labor ultimately is where that value is coming from. You're going through the effort to create this, and now that product is imbibed with the value that of your labor. Now, how you value that product and how the person you're trading values that product are going to be two different things. But in a system like this, you can't feasibly have profit exist to begin with, because the only way to actually exploit labor at this point would be to, you know, lie to somebody about the value of a product that you're trading with them, right? You'd have to use some sort of deception in order to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that make sense? Is there anything I'm not explaining clearly here? Like, do you have, like, if there's something that you would want to in more detail on? Because I'm kind of trying to go through this and give a really rough explanation, but
no, that was a very good explanation, and I'd like to talk a little bit about my own experiences. When I was in high school, I worked at Wendy's, which I'm sure many of you are aware of its existence. And when I worked at Wendy's, I would produce just tons of fries and tons of burgers. I would wash so many dishes. I would take so many orders. And the profit that was left over at the end of the day would be counted up by one of the managers. The employees never got to share in that profit. What we did get to share in was a collective misery. What we got was being yelled at, being mistreated, and being abused and dehumanized in a way that I really haven't felt outside of the context of abusive situations. And I think that when we look at work, work isn't just something that we're doing. It is something that we are selling to an employer for a wage. Work is a commodity that you are constantly selling in order to survive. And you never really get to see the full value of your labor, because where would the profit come from if you were compensated in full?
Right. Because if you put in the labor to generate, you know, to take an item that would have been $5, and let's say you have a $5 piece of wood, and you put in the labor to take that piece of wood and turn it into a chair or something. Well, now that chair is valued at $20. That $15 is value that it earned is from your labor. But if you go on to now sell that chair at $30, well, where's that extra $10 going? It's not going to you. When in not in a capitalist economy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the way the, and that's not even a really a great way of describing it either, because what's really happening is you're putting in $15 worth of value in that of, you know, labor value into making this chair, but you were only paid a set wage during that time, and if that set wage is below what you put in terms of labor value into the product, well, that's where your profit comes in.
Yeah.
That's where the profit comes in for the capitalists. And that's what they do. They pay you a wage that they know is below the value of your labor, and that's how they extract profit from you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me expound on this chair example for a little bit, and hopefully we don't run too long on this segment here. But so say that the materials for your chair are $1. You're paid a wage to craft this chair of $1, and the chairs are sold for $5. So you have a chair that's ultimately valued, quote unquote, at $5. And the company that hired you to make the chairs is getting $3 off of the top of that because they're paying you $1 and then they spent $1 for the chairs. And let's even be fair and take $1 out of that for, you know, upkeep of equipment or whatever. So they're getting $2 off the top of that. Now this is sort of a rough segue into this next section, but imagine if you wanted to start an opposing chair company and you work harder and longer hours than everybody else to make better chairs because you want to hopefully sway people into buying your chairs rather than this like company's mass-produced chairs. So say you take twice as many hours to make one chair. You take 2 hours instead of 1 hour per chair. When the market has easy access to mass-produced chairs at half the time for less cost because you're working less, they're going to take those chairs and they're going to be skimming more profit off of every chair because they have to pay less for the materials and the labor to make them.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Was
that
working? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, the capitalism is when you really boil it down, capitalism is the ultimate multi-level marketing scheme.
Exactly. It's like a pyramid scheme, except it's a little bit useful sometimes, but it still barely even works. Like, at the end of the day, like, we're still at the bottom of the pyramid, and the people on top are chucking rocks down at us.
Right. Yeah, and you hear people talk about, like, how good products used to be. Like, oh, yes, things were built so much sturdier back in the day. That's, like, there's a reason for that. Because as things get easier to produce and materials get cheaper, capitalists are always going to choose the cheaper option so they can skim more profit off of the top.
Yeah. Right. Also, like, it's good for them for your products to be breaking down every couple of years because then you gotta buy more products.
Right, like that's literally a feature from their perspective. Yeah.
So I think we should be wrapping up with that tangent now. Because
yeah, I agree. Like, cause we could literally spend an entire podcast talking about this and not even come close to answering everyone's questions about it because it's such a, like, in terms of, like, if anybody's curious about labor theory of value, and if you're inclined to push yourself in this way, Das Kapital, Karl Marx's magnum opus, if you will, is where I would really recommend checking it out. And I recommend doing it with some friends or in a group or something because it's dense.
Yeah. Whoa, are you a communist? Crazy.
I just might be.
Holy shit.
I can't.
But yeah, anyways,
I hope that was useful. I don't know.
I hope you all enjoyed our explanations of the labor theory of value and crises of overproduction. And now we are going to get into some of the history. So I have a bunch of notes. I have so many notes. I have so many notes on Paint Creek and Cabin Creek. And I want to tell you guys all about them. I need to stop saying them so much.
It's okay.
So, once again, we are going back to the Cold Wars. However, we are going to a different state in a different, well, kind of concurrent time period to the Ludlow Massacre, but different sort of context. So, West Virginia was one of those states which had some of a Union presence, but not much. It was recognized as one of the states that was not under Union control for a very long time. And what happened in the Paint and Cabin Creek instances were actually pretty interesting because they started out as wildcat strikes. And a wildcat strike is when non-union members of a workforce just decide to go on strike of their own volition. So, the Cabin Creek miners submitted a bunch of demands which inspired the Paint Creek miners. And the Cabin Creek miners' demands were, 1, union recognition, 2, rights of free speech and peaceable assembly, 3, an end to blacklisting of union men, 4, an end to compulsory trading at company-owned stores, 5, an end to cribbing, which was the practice of constructing wooden cribs on the side of the mine cars to make them hold more coal, and then paying the piecework miner as though the car were of ordinary size, so they were just getting ripped off, and the establishment of 2,000 pounds as a ton of coal for which they were to be paid. Prior to that, they were being paid by long tons, which were 2,200 pounds, which were a lot harder to haul, and a lot more work for the miners. Number 7, they wanted the right to check weighmen selected and paid by the miners. And 8, the joint saying by the company and miner check weighmen of all docking penalties for impurities in the coal mine. So basically, if you hauled some coal and some was impure, they would dock that from your pay. And they wanted an end to that. The operators, very shockingly, rejected all of these demands, and the Cabin Creek miners struck. The Paint Creek miners also submitted some demands. Their demands were less exhaustive, however, they were still important. They wanted union half cents per ton below the piece rate in other union areas, and they wanted to eradicate this differential. They wanted to be paid in the same way that the union miners were being paid. So the mine operators refused this demand, and the miners struck. Another factor leading to the eventual strike was that wages were falling. I'm not exactly sure what the pattern was, but they were seeing pretty significant wage cuts. And the thing is, like, when your boss cuts your wage and everything is still the same price, if not more expensive, then that makes it impossible to live. So you have the option of either dying from, like, starvation, or you have the option of going on strike and signing up with the union and trying to, get a better life for yourself. So these wildcat strikes were initiated by the workers without the initial support of the UMW, the United Mine Workers Union. However, the UMW was eager to make inroads into West Virginia, so they sent Mother Jones and UMW Vice President Frank Harris to assist in the strike. The miners were being armed by the UMWA. The UMWA sent them 6 machine guns, 1,000 high-powered rifles, and 50,000 rounds of ammunition. And in response to this, the coal company started hiring Baldwin Feltz, once again, our favorite guys. So Baldwin Feltz set up a bunch of concrete forts with machine guns, and they started evicting miners from their homes. In the process of this, they destroyed $40,000 in personal property. So not only are the miners on strike and being subjected to horrible conditions, and at this point having guns being pointed at them, but their personal property was destroyed.
And that's, like, a lot of money, like, you know, considering the time when this was, $40,000 in personal property, like...
Yeah. Yeah.
That they had to really destroy a lot of stuff of these people's, they had to destroy a lot of these miners' things in order to achieve that much destruction, like, goodness.
Yeah. Imagine somebody just came into your house and just started throwing away all of your stuff.
Right, like, right. Yeah.
That's... Yeah, it's wild. It's incredible that somebody could do such a thing. This resulted in a secret march of 3,000 armed miners on the state capitol to declare war on the state of West Virginia. They declared their intent to kill the mine guards and destroy the coal company's operations. And then they attacked Mucklow. This did not make the... state government happy. The miners were armed, they were attacking, so there was this tent city, because when the miners who were trying to unionize were evicted, they were sent to a tent city, which was set up by the union, and the union would provide them with, like, food and whatever amenities they might need in order to continue the strike. And the tent city was growing and the miners were armed. So this led West Virginia's governor, William E. Glasscock, very funny name, to declare martial law and send in the state militia. It basically had the same pattern as Ludlow. The state militia, or the National Guard, was sent in. They were initially welcomed by the miners. Miners were actually, like, waving American flags at them, and they thought that they were going to restore order and protect them from the company guards and the Baldwin Felt operators. But the miners would soon realize that they were actually there to break the strike. The National Guard confiscated 1,872 high-powered rifles, 556 pistols, 6 machine guns, 225,000 rounds of ammunition, 480 blackjacks, and a large number of daggers, bayonets, and brass knuckles from the miners.
What's a blackjack?
It's a club.
Ah, gotcha. Okay.
Oh, I thought it was a bomb.
No, they're like billy clubs.
I see. So, martial law was declared, and at least 60 people were tried in military courts without regard for their rights. Many state militia members stayed after martial law was over and worked for the coal companies as guards. So the state militia was basically just in bed with the coal operators. And when it came time to declare martial law again, and then martial law again for a third time, the same sorts of military courts were set up and people were sentenced to prison with little regards for their rights. And this was because of, like, the conflict that was happening between the miners and the mine owners. Before we get to the very end of it, I just want to quickly go over the Bull Moose special, because this is another instance of Baldwin Felt being incredibly cruel. So, the Bull Moose special was a Baldwin Felt's train car that was fitted with machine guns. It was an armored train car, and they drove it through Holly Grove, which was where the tent colony was, with all the miners inside, and they just shot into the tent colony. They killed Francis Francesco Estep, making national headlines and enraging the miners.
I have to say, sometimes it's almost a miracle at some of these instances that they didn't end up killing more people than they actually did.
Yeah, right? I would have expected a much larger body count from that.
Well, my guess would be by this... Well, yeah, honestly, I don't know. It's one of those things... well, I mean, I know the death toll gets higher as we go on anyway, but yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a few hypotheses, right? Like, you could say that Baldwin Felts were just inept. You could say that the miners sort of expected that they would be attacked. Or you could say that maybe Baldwin Felts were warned not to kill that many of them and just to scare them because they still needed these people to work the mines.
Right, they may have just been, like, shooting above everybody instead of actually shooting into the tents directly.
Yeah.
But they still managed to kill somebody, I mean, shit.
Right. Well, it's funny that you say that they were told not to, hurt the miners, because the coal operators were actually on the Bull Moose special shooting at the miners with them.
Oh, nice.
So here's a quote from a book I read. A particularly brutal incident occurred on February 7th, 1913. The sheriff of Kanawha County, several of his deputies, a coal operator named Quinn Morton, and several mine guards traveled to Paint Creek in a specially armored train car called the Bull Moose Special to serve a John Doe warrant for inciting a riot. As the train passed through Holly Grove, a miner's tent colony, Morton and his mine guards sprayed rifle and machine gun fire into the colony. Morton was reported to have said, "We gave them hell and had a lot of fun. Let's go back and give them another round." One person was killed and several others were wounded. And nobody involved in these shootings ever saw the inside of a jail cell. They never saw, any hits to their status or their prestige. They basically stayed rich for the rest of their lives. Like I mentioned on the last episode, Baldwin and Felts both became private bankers and were actually very successful. So these people who served the interest of capital were essentially just getting off scot-free for their atrocity. So at the end of all of it, at the end of the battles in Paint Creek and Cabin Creek, the soldiers arrested 200 strikers and strike leaders, including Mother Jones, and they tried to imprison many of them. Coal operators were exonerated. Mother Jones was held for 85 days before being released, and the treatment of the miners enraged the country, but nothing really changed. There is one, like, nice little bit. Henry Hatfield was later elected the governor of West Virginia, and Hatfield was sympathetic to the miners and settled the conflict by giving them higher pay, the right to a check weighman, and a temporary respite from trading in company stores. He was also the one who released Mother Jones after her 85 days. So, it wasn't necessarily the case that things turned out well in the end, but they got somebody in office who was a little bit more sympathetic towards them. And I would like to end our brief coverage of the Painted Cabin Creek massacres and uprisings with a quote from Senator Kenyon, who was one of the senators overseeing the Donahue Commission. He lists the causes of the uprisings as follows. Among them might be related the employment of mine guards. High prices charged the miners at company stores, mine guards acting as deputy sheriffs, post offices located in company stores, private roads to the schools and stores, no opportunity to purchase homes, cemeteries upon company grounds, attempts to unionize the miners, alien ownership of large tracts of land, in one instance 12,000 acres. All of these various things appearing in the testimony might be cited as causes leading up to the conditions which the committee investigated. However, it is the opinion of some of the committee that the cause of all this trouble is deeper and more fundamental. The basic cause is the private ownership of great public necessities, such as coal. This, coupled with human greed, incident to such ownership, has brought about the deplorable and un-American conditions in the West Virginia coal fields under investigation.
Yeah, that's a lot.
He hit the nail on the head.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting to hear them talking about the issue of private ownership of public what would amount to public resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I really couldn't have said it any better myself. I think he puts it very well. Because private ownership of public resources is a huge problem. Private ownership of food and housing and coal and electricity is a major issue because they, the capitalists will always do what is in their best interest. They will do what gets them the most profits. And that often is offloaded onto us. That is a burden that we have to bear all the time.
Yeah, and I mean, even in the rare instances in our country today, where states will have their own state-owned utilities, they're still at the mercy of the markets, and they're still at the mercy of the capitalists who are lobbying to have certain things enacted to benefit, you know, whoever's actually selling you this electricity or gas or water or what have you.
Yeah.
For I mean, sure. Look at climate change. I mean, Exxon knew what they were doing and what they were doing and what it was causing to the planet. They knew that back in the 60s and 70s. And yeah, that's not a conspiracy theory or anything like that. It's a legitimate conspiracy. Yeah. That's what they did.
The documents are public.
Yeah, you could go and read about this yourself. And you will find that not only do they know about all this, but they made an active decision to hide it from the public.
And it's because of this private ownership that we never switched to alternative energy in any meaningful way.
The only reason they do this is for profit. Like, that was the only motivation for doing that, for sending us down this path and causing untold damage and harm to so many people. All for profit.
Yeah. It's really despicable.
I'd like to call out the people listening now that don't care about what we're saying and are still going to support profits over people, and go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
We should cut that.
Isabel did it earlier. Why can't I do it?
I don't think we should be telling the audience to go fuck themselves. So yeah, that's Pan Cabin Creek. Hey guys, what's an outro?
Outro? I hardly knew her.
Yo, that's a very good point. I want. I feel dead inside. Anyway,
we all feel dead inside.
We're recording this outro after just like a ridiculously long week or so, and yeah, it's been a lot.
Yeah, we've been working hard, not hardly working. But yeah, we hope you guys enjoyed the episode, and keep a lookout for the next episode of Blood, Sweat, and Strife in about 2 weeks.